You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. Whole Foods Market creates win-win partnerships with our suppliers, and we love to tell their stories. Simply Grazin Organic Farm, a family-owned operation, provides some of the highest standards in animal welfare around. Their 100% grass-fed beef comes from cows grazing outdoors with very little interference from the husband and wife team behind them. Come have a taste in one of our six Manhattan locations.
And good morning. This is Taste Matters. I am Karen Karp, filling in for Mitchell Davis today. I am the president and founder of a food consulting business in New York called Karp Resources. And as many of you listeners know, the show Taste Matters takes a cultural construct of taste and how it relates to the socio-cultural political implications of our food choices and eating behaviors. For my guest segments on Taste Matters, I'll be focusing on how taste matters in the public sector, so to speak, how taste factors into policy and the food business and our changing culture around food behavior in New York City, particularly where and when and how food is consumed in the public sector. Today, we're going to be speaking about school food, one of the great public institutions serving food in New York City to 1.2 million children, about 860,000 meals a day. And I have two wonderful guests with me here today, Mimi Sheraton, who I will ask to introduce herself in just a moment, and Eric Goldstein. I picked school food because, well, many of our listeners may be aware or unaware that the National School Lunch Program in the United States started in the 1940s, but in 1863, the New York City-based Children's Aid Society started serving lunches to children in schools in New York City, mostly because what people were realizing was kids at home weren't getting all the nutrition that they really needed. There just wasn't enough good food at home regularly for children to be paying attention in school and learning well. So there is a long history of advocacy to improve school food, certainly for the last 20 years that I've been in this business and beyond, and as Mimi will explain, some of the work that she's done in this area. And I think with some of the things I want to talk about today are how advocacy has turned to partnership, how different kinds of interventions are coming into the schools, both from groups coming in and partnering with the schools and the schools themselves professionalizing in a new way to improve the schools. And then looking at some of the specific trends around local food and cultural diversity. So I invited you both here today to talk about the changing paradigms of food in restaurants and school meals in New York City in general, and what you see as some of the key issues that have been addressed, where there are improvements that have been made, and how New York City is a world-class food city and what we need to do to become more of one. So Mimi, let's start with you. We met about 18 years ago when you were an advisor on an early project of mine called One City Cafe. But you are most well known probably as a food writer, certainly, and as one of the New York Times early restaurant critics. So I'd like you to just talk a little bit about how you got interested in the topic of school food and what you did with that interest and who assigned you to start working on this topic.
Well, to begin with, nobody assigned me. What I'm interested in overall is institutional food, why it always is, what it almost always is, how it can be improved, what makes it work. Mm-hmm. I was curious about school food in New York City shortly after I got to the New York Times. Some have suggested it was my way of doing penance for all of the luxury eating I got to do as restaurant critic, salve for my conscience. But I don't think it really was that, because many years ago I read a book by Alexis Soyer, who was the great French chef in Victorian England, who, among other things, went to Turkey during the Crimean War at the request of Florence Nightingale to see if the army food and the hospital food in that war, Üsküdar, it was where they were encamped, could be improved. And he wrote this book about all of the things he did to improve what was then institutional hospital food. And by coincidence or fate, in about 46 years ago, I had a very bad accident and had a broken foot and needed a skin graft. And I was in NYU Hospital for 2 weeks. And I had already been doing consulting to restaurant associates writing about food. And I thought, this hospital food is terrible. And I kept complaining to my doctor, who brought up the head of the hospital, who on the spot gave me a one-year contract, beginning when I could walk, to see what I could do about the food at the NYU Hospital, then called University, now called Tisch at Langone, or a bunch of hedge fund names.
Yes.
But the hedge fund hospital. But and so I began, and it was really an education, the whole psychology of institutional food, the whole idea. And of course, having been an employee and an executive, I've eaten in employee and executive cafeterias, flown on airlines, that's another aspect of even highway feeding is an example of it. It's what's called a captive audience.
Right.
That is almost the defining term. And so I went to about 125 schools all around the country to compare the school food lunches. And I've just become interested. And since I have gone to Rikers Island, which I reported on the food for the New York Observer many years ago, etc.
Right, great. And you grew up in Midwood, correct?
I grew up in Brooklyn, the Midwood section of Brooklyn, and went to Midwood High School.
And you had lunches at high school.
We did indeed. Some kids brought lunch, but I always lost the lunch I brought because I think I really didn't want to carry it around.
Right.
Besides, I've always had a crazy obsession with eating in restaurants, and I would always rather buy what I feel like having at the moment than a sandwich I carried around for 2 hours.
That's interesting. I live with someone who has that exact same philosophy about food. Eric, you're with us by phone today. I understand you are downtown at Tweed, at the headquarters of the Department of Education, and we're sorry you can't be with us personally, but we're glad to have you on the phone. You grew up in Flushing, is that correct?
Well, a little outside of Flushing. I grew up in a place called Fresh Meadows, but pretty close to Flushing. And I should say, Karen and Mimi, great to be on the show. And Mimi, nice to meet you, at least by telephone. And Karen, of course, great to speak to you again.
Yes, thank you.
I hope we can do it someday in person, Eric.
Great.
I'd really like that, Mimi.
So, Eric, you are on, I think it's your second round of duty at the Department of Education. We met a couple years ago after you returned to assume a new role, which is as the chief executive overseeing all of school support services, which does include school food as well as transportation and facilities, I believe. And I guess I'd like, now that you've been in this role for a couple years and food is, I'm sure, the thing people want you to talk about the most, maybe, I'd like to hear, when they asked you to come back to assume this role, what did they say was the job they really wanted you to do? What was the challenge that you were most facing in taking this job?
I refer to that hiatus as my junior year abroad.
Okay.
but going through a lot of challenges. I mean, the school food revolution, really, as we sort of refer to it internally, and it has been revolutionary if you look at where we started when this mayor came in to where we are now, and it has been a sort of continuum of progress. You know, we tried to reinvent it, and this, you cannot separate whether it's restaurant food, I would imagine, if I'm so bold to speak about that, or certainly institutional food, which I know a lot about, from the culture at large. It's just impossible to divorce those things because they just act and influence one another.
Sure.
So the culture was one of change, clearly focused on educational change, with Department of Education, after all. But food was a part of that.
Yes.
And the mayor and the chancellor at the time, and continues under this chancellor, wanted to have continual change in food to make it more appropriate for the educational mission and more in line, and as a both a reaction to, but also as a catalyst for, the general larger cultural changes. So really what we've been very, very focused on is making sure within school food we have the right governance to affect change, because after all, we're dealing with a very large institution inside of an even larger institution. inside of an even larger city.
Mm-hmm.
So that structure is really important, but also a sense of mission and purpose. What is it we're trying to achieve? And then, of course, thinking clearly and soberly, how are we going to try to achieve and affect change? Because change happens both in sort of step change types of ways, but also in small incremental type of ways. So how do we sort of string that all together to sort of get us along the pathway of where we want to go? I don't think there is necessarily a destination point. It's very much about the journey and about making ourselves better and better and better.
Sure.
And that's really been the focus in many, many different ways.
Right. So some of the things I know about through the work that I've done with school food, which has mostly been before you came back, but a little bit since you've been back, is that the Department of Education created a new position, which is executive chef, and that's a position that's less than 10 years old. It's really an innovation. There's a salad bar initiative. Last I heard, you were at least one-third of the way of having a salad bar in every school. There are about 1,600 schools in New York City. Certainly, there's the farm-to-school movement has kind of taken over the nation, and I know that you have embraced that with quite a lot of passion. What are some of the other things that are going on in school food now that are really kind of following the general food trends, would you say? And then I'd like to ask Mimi what she thinks about those things as matching up to the trends that she sees.
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, those things are revolutionary because, you know, when we came here for school food, we didn't think that much about food, really.
Uh-huh.
It was really, the emphasis was on service. So making sure we ticked the boxes, making sure that the food was served. So we had to redo the whole thing, soup mm-hmm. to nuts, so mm-hmm. to speak, if you can pardon that metaphor. So we had to reinvent the uniforms that our staff was wearing. We called ourselves school food as opposed to the Office of School Food Nutritional Services,
mm-hmm.
which I'm not sure exactly what that meant. And then focused a lot with the chef, and we continue to this day in a more intense way, more than ever, on menu and ingredients,
yes,
which we never really did before.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a fundamental philosophical change in how we approach things. And look, it's a big city. You're never going to make everyone happy in the city, but certainly in the space we're in, which we do have to say parenthetically, have to explain to a lot of people because it's a little confusing, but we're in a big institutional space, so looking at other districts, what they're doing, certainly other large urban districts, and what we always want to do is, whether it's through the how we're structured and bringing in an executive chef and a team of chefs who help us go out and train our cooks in the school on how to do things, like, for instance, to support our salad bar initiatives, how to blanch vegetables, because that's not something that you're just born with. You have to be taught that skill. So how do we teach that skill to our folks in a grand scale so it's relatively the same whether we do it in the Upper Bronx or in the lower part of Staten Island?
Right.
So we can share that knowledge. So really thinking in a large, large way on how do we not only push these initiatives, but to support these initiatives so they're really, really successful.
Yeah, it's a little bit like Back to the Future. I read some of Mimi's articles over the weekend, which were published in the New York Times in the mid to late 70s, about her investigation about school food around the country. And at the time, the notion was fast food was an improvement in the schools. Can you say a little bit about that, Mimi, what
well,
you saw?
Well, that was a period of disaster in the New York City schools because a lot of schools, especially at the elementary level, had pulled out their kitchens and were serving what amounted to TV dinners. Some supplier had sold them this idea. They had only convection ovens for reheating these miserable little, what I call TV dinners. And it was also a time of ethnic polarization in the city when each ethnic group wanted its food represented on the school menu. It was a time when parents were dumping food trucks outside the school, and there were a lot of union issues about housekeeping within the schools, mm-hmm. the sanitation services. So it was a very argumentative period. And when you asked the kids what they wanted, they all said they wanted American food.
Mm-hmm.
What was American food? Pizza, spaghetti, hot dogs, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. The kids wanted to eat and get out and play.
Right.
It's a very different problem in the upper schools than it is in the lower school, because right. all sorts of things figure in upper schools. Identity, are they getting a free lunch? Is there a stigma? The girls don't want to eat. They choose lunches their last period and leave. So it's very complex. But at that time, the issue was ethnic foods versus American foods, and being tied to a system in which there was no kitchen. Donated commodities, for example, were sent to food processors, not cooked in the schools.
Right.
A baker, a commercial bakery, turned the flour into bread.
Yep.
Whereas in a city like Milwaukee, which I went to for balance, everyone in the school had the same meal every day, no choices, and they prepared all of the donated commodities. So it was simpler. New York is a more complex city.
Right, and that was a time in New York when things were really rough all over.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, the polarization was simply terrible.
Yep.
And Puerto Rican mothers who had a real passion about having their children eat properly brought hot meals to the school and made the kids sit on steps, benches, wherever,
right.
and watched them eat the lunch
yep.
before they could.
We're going to take a short break and come back and talk about some of the changes, some of the very specific delicious changes that are happening in school food in New York.
Play food songs.
Well, I was thinking long and hard about the song because I got to choose it. Next time you can choose the song. And I decided to choose a song that was optimistic and about better days, because what I'm starting to see in New York City and around the country in all of our work is that food is really getting better in a lot of places where it was not so good for the last 30 or 40 years. And in my opinion, New York City schools are doing some of the most amazing work that I've seen generally, and also because of the size of the system. Sharing with Mimi earlier before the show that I remember the first day that I was going to work on the evaluation we did for School Food Plus a number of years ago. I was going to East Harlem to do an evaluation, and we were invited there for lunch, and I was absolutely terrified. I did not grow up in New York City, and I grew up on Long Island, and I did go to public school, but I never ate the school meals for any number of reasons, mostly because I was an extraordinarily picky eater as a child. But I remember the feeling of terror I had riding the number 6 train to, I forget what school it was, in East Harlem. And the very first thing we were doing was having lunch with some of the teachers and with the principal of the school. And to my extreme delight, I mean, I had food in my car ready to eat something later. I was just really, I just didn't know what to expect. The food was absolutely delicious. It was barbecue chicken. The glaze was perfect. There were baked plantains, of course not fried. Things are not fried anymore in the schools. There was a salad. And except for the fact that it was on styrofoam plates, the food was utterly delightful. And it made me think, this is going to be a really interesting project. And one of the things, and maybe Eric, you can tell me if you think this is the right approach. One of the things I learned when we started working with school food is that there's so much advocacy out there and so much being written about what's wrong with schools. But typically, the things that are being written are by people who don't know how any of these systems actually work, and that they don't know what your job is every day, which is to go in and make sure that 860,000 meals are prepared on time, in budget, and nobody gets sick from them. And I just thought that's the thing that we need to think about when we're thinking about changing a system. We have to understand what the bottom line objective every day is: to feed all these kids a nutritious meal on time and make sure that your budget at the end of the day works. And then everything else is additive to that. And it's the everything else that is the fun of what you're doing now. So I just want to test that theory with you. Is that correct?
Yeah, look, it's a massive operation. I mean, the thing that I really am very proud of is the skill level we have mm-hmm. with our people. And one of the things we've been working on a lot, as I mentioned earlier, is how do we train our people? Mm-hmm. How do we train our people on how to merchandise the food? So, for instance, we got a grant that we work with the Department of Health to hire some extra chefs just to help us work on salad bar issues.
Yep.
I mentioned the blanching of the broccoli or the cauliflower, mm-hmm. but also how it's prepared, how different kids in different grades eat and think about food. So, for instance, elementary school kids generally shy away from compound salads, and they'll like their cut celery or tomatoes separate. They shouldn't touch one another, where in high school kids, a compound salad is more acceptable. How do we think about that? How do we react to that? How do we merchandise that to the kids?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, really important. But, also on the supply chain, we're very excited this month. We're releasing for a few days, the first time ever, collard greens. And I personally worked on that with Chef Jorge for a while for a supplier down in South Carolina for collard greens, because it's just a really great vegetable, nutrient-rich. But, of course, how are we going to prepare it when it actually goes through, when you do all that work and it hits the menu? Well, the kids eat it, right?
That's right.
They're going to be the ones who are going to tell you yes or no. And then you butt up against all the things that Mimi was mentioning. So the cultural takes on the food, do they like it, do they don't like it, how is it menued, how is it merchandised, how do we present it? So all these things come together in this really complex stew. And it really comes down to, are the kids going to take it and the kids going to eat it? So
that's right. That's right. And I remember one of the things when I was doing some of the work with school food that Chef Jorge really impressed upon me, which is a little bit of the opposite of what Mimi mentioned a few minutes ago, which is that actually, Karen, no, we want Thai vegetable blends. We want Mexican vegetable blends. We want an Asian stir fry. So that some of what has become more mainstream on the school food menus are actually I would say not the reverse, but the evolution back to an appreciation of cultural diversity. Would you say that there's, how would you describe how that occurred, Mimi, over the last 30 years in New York City, if kids then wanted to be eating American and now the focus is actually to create a range of menu items that express the range of cultures in New York? How did that happen?
I think it depends on the level of immigration, first generation, second generation. The closer children are to another country of origin, the more American they want the food to be that they eat,
mm-hmm.
because they feel it's a demeaning identification to insist on their native foods. And I did for 2 or 3 years at Midwood High School, I had a program with English as second language students based on food criticism.
Oh, fascinating.
And we thought, Clyde Haberman did a column on this in the New York Times, and I thought if I could get the kids to talk about food, we could get them, they had to talk in English and write in English, and that they would forget that they don't know English in their passion to say something about the food.
Sweet.
So we critiqued the food in the Midwood cafeteria, and they were very eloquent, I can assure you. And they began to do critiques in the little restaurants around Midwood. But in the beginning, I asked the kids to list the foods they ate at home. And there were Haitian kids and Nigerian kids and kids from all over at Midwood. And they were all putting down American foods. And I said to the Haitian, don't you eat John John rice? Don't you eat Kalalu Aki? Mm-hmm. They were so stunned that I knew about it, that their secret was out. And I said, no, it's more interesting to know what you really eat.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you don't eat fried chicken and pizza at home. And so they began to talk about their own foods and critique the food. And there was more awareness. When children are second and third generation Americans, they are less sensitive and they are more likely to want the mix of food mm-hmm. that they read about in New York publications and which have become fashionable. The danger is when you try to do that, and of course you do the best you can, is that they'll say, well, that's not the way my mother made it. Or this doesn't taste as good as Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Right.
So
we have memory and commercialism all fading, all figuring into the recipe.
Right. Should you do something they know about, or should you do something they don't know about?
Right.
And of course, what they say and what they actually pick up to eat can be vastly different.
Sure.
Because they all said they wanted raw vegetables and salads, and when they were put out at Midwood, they didn't touch them.
That's right.
I said you wanted vegetables. Why didn't you eat them? They said there's no shield over the vegetable bar and people can sneeze. Well, I didn't see anyone sneeze, but I thought, it's just another step on...
Right. Well, that technical part has been sorted out, right, Eric? Every salad bar has a sneeze guard, as I know it.
Yeah, no, I mean, we go through some pretty rigorous inspections,
sure.
I can tell you for sure, that nothing slides.
Right.
But, the salad bar is important. I mean, just to build on this point, two points. I think Mimi raised something really excellent that we think about. Is as we try to diversify the menu to get people familiar with it, we do think about it's very hard to compete with what Mama makes. It's never going to be as good. First of all, we're more regimented in our standards and our recipes in terms of what we will allow in terms of sodium and other types of things.
Mm-hmm.
But also, just deviating from that for a second to the salad bars, I mean, what we really recognize, and bringing up the earlier point I made is, trying to sort of nudge culture along, is that, productivity in American culture is at a premium. And the cousin of productivity is convenience, right? And
mm-hmm.
that's why, we think about, why a fast food place is so popular, reading some of the research out there, and then thinking about that and how we could use, for instance, salad bars in the same type of vein. If we have salad bars and we make them look good and we make them convenient
mm-hmm.
for the kids are going to go to the salad bars, they're going to use the salad bars. It will have the primary effect of having them eat salad, and that's really well and good, and then the secondary effect of them going home to their parents and saying, hey, how is it that we don't have carrots at home?
Right.
I eat these carrots at school, and they're really good, and we should have carrots at home. Mom, could you please buy some carrots? And then hopefully the mother will respond to that.
Sam.
But, of course, we're very, let's not hide from this. We're very regimented. We have to listen and abide by rules set out by the Department of Agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And, in school food, we try to push the envelope because we don't get reimbursed any extra for the salad bars, which I think is a real shame on the USDA for not allowing us to do that or other districts to do that, because that's how you do really start to affect some major change. But, you have to sort of start to push the culture.
Yes.
React to the culture and push the culture.
Just a little question. Is there a dressing for the vegetables at the salad bar?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
A choice of dressings?
There is, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So, well, the salad bar question, what you just mentioned, I was actually explaining to Mimi how that it isn't, before the show, how that, which is an extreme cost in your overall budget because it's all fresh fruits and vegetables, is not reimbursed. That gets us to the question of policy that's on the horizon that is in motion to help you do, Eric, what you do better. So last year, there was a stipulation in one piece of legislation, I don't remember which one it was, that's going to allow a few cents more per meal specifically for fresh fruits and vegetables for school meals. Can you tell us, is that actually going through? And what other things are on the pike that you hope can really help elevate the quality of fresh, healthy food that you're producing in the schools?
Yeah, we're going to be coming out with a bid
mm-hmm.
soon for produce and some vegetables. We want to layer in and leverage the existing legislation that the council was gracious enough to pass that we can then use to have some more local things come in. Certainly in New York State, we're looking at, apples and onions and cabbage and
mm-hmm.
romaine lettuce,
mm-hmm.
and then looking to branch that out to, for some more regional product. But, of course, we get product from all over the place because, as I mentioned earlier, we got collard greens from South Carolina. It's a great vegetable, and we want to see if we can do that well. I'm really curious to see how the response is to that. But really trying from our supply chain to tease out some of the produce and the vegetables to see if we can't buy it at a little bit better price. We got volume. We're actually, I could say, having worked a lot in the private sector, the DOE is actually excellent at buying things,
mm-hmm.
Which most people don't know,
mm-hmm.
And then how we could focus on that and buy some better quality produce. So we're really excited about that. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out over the next few months as we release this bid and then open the bid.
Are children given glasses of water when they pick up their meal, or do they have to get the water either from a fountain or buy a bottle?
Well, no, we don't have bottles and we don't have glasses. What we do is, in some schools we have, and they've been very successful, the water bubblers. Mm-hmm. Those have been really successful, and we started deploying them. In other schools, we have now sort of thermoses. Some schools do have water fountains, but we found the whole mix, probably the water bubblers are the most successful because kids mm-hmm. want the water to be cool. They yep. want it to be yep. clear. It needs to be fresh.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Great, great. We are 1 minute away from wrapping up the show. I do want to just pick up on one little thing Eric just mentioned, which is that school food is an enormous buyer of food, and when they change their specifications for food, it drives change throughout the industry and all sorts of other public institutions around the state, around the country, in New York City, can benefit from the changes that school food tries to make in their specifications. So I don't know if we're completely out of time or not, but I guess one final question from each of you is, what is your fondest memory of school food from growing up in New York City?
Well, mine is Friday at Midwood High School, which was Chow Mein Day.
Okay.
And there was always a little sign out, Chin and Lee's Chow Mein, and that's what everybody took that day.
Great.
And that's my fondest memory.
Eric, how about you from Queens?
At heart, I'm a Queens guy. I do love pizza.
All right. Well, that is a great New York food, and we do know how to make it really well. I would like to thank both of you for being my guests today. This was a really fun discussion. Eric, I have a copy of Mimi's book, Eating My Words, for you, that she brought as a little gift. I'll make sure that we get it to you. And
please,
I hope that we can speak again about food in the public sector as Taste Matters. Thanks.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Here is...
Okay. Great.
Listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from Food Karma. To kick off the New York City Meat Week in style, Meat with a Twist will bring together the best chefs and mixologists for a cocktail food pairing party on November 7th from 6 to 10 p.m. at City Winery. Meat with a Twist features 10 cocktails paired with 10 chef selections highlighting local, sustainably grown meat such as duck, lamb, chicken, pork, beef, bison, and ostrich. The party will launch a week's worth of events throughout the city that celebrate the slow food movement bringing sustainable meats to our tables. Again, that's November 7th from 6 to 10 p.m. at City Winery. Updates, tickets, and more information are available at meetweeknyc.com.